The Sports Illustrated Media Podcast is brought to you by T-Mobile. This baseball season, T-Mobile customers can get a free season-long subscription to MLB.tv Premium. Sign up by April 10th at T-Mobile.com/MLB or sign up for MLB.tv while on T-Mobile's network. We're also brought to you by Harry's Razors. Superior razors ship straight to your door at half the drugstore price. Get $5 off your first order by using the code SIMedia at harrys.com and by FanDuel. Now that baseball is back, you can try the fun and competition of daily fantasy risk-free for up to 10 bucks. Go to FanDuel.com and enter the code SIMedia.
I keep thinking these days as we listen to the litany of stuff about race that's going on, whether it's a presidential candidate who wants to take a couple of days to decide whether he wants to discredit or disown a relationship with white supremacy and the Ku Klux Klan, or whether it's yet another murder of an African American at the hand of police, or whether it's something about race. How much we need Jackie Robinson, and how contemporary the film that Sarah Burns and David McMahon and I told is without us intending it to be. That if you, you know, this has got stories of the Confederate flag and driving while black and stop and frisk and black churches and Black Lives Matter and all that sort of stuff. The only thing that's in a film should be what works. And, you know, the only time the President and the First Lady, like everyone else in the film, like every piece of music, like every shot, like every talking head, like every first-person voice read magnificently by Jamie Foxx, is because it works.
Welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast, where each week we interview a member of the sports media. I'm your host, Richard Deitch. My producer is Bette Marston. And this week our guest is a little off the beaten path, not necessarily traditionally a quote-unquote member of the sports media, but it is Ken Burns, the Emmy Award-winning filmmaker whose widely known documentaries include The Civil War, Baseball, Jazz, The War, Prohibition, The Central Park Five, and the Roosevelts, if I'm missing one or a couple, apologies. But Ken Burns is one of the foremost documentarians in this country, and no doubt you are familiar with his work. Now he and his co-director, Sarah Burns, I believe that is his daughter, and David McMahon bring us Jackie Robinson, a two-part, four-hour film on the American baseball icon that will air on PBS April 11th and 12th. On PBS April 11th and April 12th, check your local listings. The film is sensational. I've seen a screening of it, and it is, you know, as Ken Burns' work before, it is really, really impressive. Martin Luther King Jr. famously said of Jackie Robinson, he was a sinner before sinners, a freedom rider before freedom rides. And this two-part documentary really gets into the life of Jackie prior to him joining the Dodgers, his years in Montreal before the Dodgers, and then obviously his years with the Dodgers and his work on civil rights during his baseball career and afterwards, and just the kind of burden that he dealt with. Died at 53, very young, and it's really an impressive work. And you know, from Rachel Robinson to Barack Obama and Michelle Obama, some amazing people on this film. So Ken Burns will join us this week. My thanks to our previous guests, Renee Young of the WWE, Hubie Brown. Incredible feedback from that. Thank you so much. And Zach Lowe. So we got a couple basketball ones if you want to catch up on with Zach Lowe and Hubie Brown. And Renee Young, the WWE broadcaster on the heels of WrestleMania 32. And now for the rare segue from WrestleMania 32 to documentary filmmaker Ken Burns, let's bring in Ken Burns, co-director of Jackie Robinson. Ken, welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. We appreciate you being here.
Thank you, Richard. It's my pleasure and honor.
Ken, a lot of this podcast is about process and how people do what they do in the sports media. But before we get into a little bit of that, when I knew you were going to come on, I'm always interested in this with your films, and that is, how do you determine success when it comes to your work?
You know, I think I talk a good game. But at the heart of it, I'm interested in being a good storyteller. And I'm sure Sarah Burns and David McMahon, who made this film on Jackie Robinson with me, would agree that, we're just looking for a good story. And more often than not, that story is one that defies the superficiality of our conventional media wisdom. You know, we're inundated with information, and everything tends to be too much at the top. And what I've enjoyed about my relationship of nearly 40 years with public broadcasting is that I'm able to dive deep and go deep and do the stories in the sort of detail and the complexity with all the undertow that they deserve. I'm always really thrilled that people always say, I had no idea, or I didn't know that, or I thought I knew everything about such and such, but... And that makes me really, really happy. So I think when you're faced with the idea of Jackie Robinson, we all know who he is. He's a kind of mythological figure, but that mythological figure is now encrusted with the barnacles of sentimentality and nostalgia, and a lot of the stuff is just mythology. It's just not true, and we've sort of turned him into a shorthand for our own wishes and desires, when the real person is so interesting and so contemporary. I mean, I keep thinking these days as we listen to the litany of stuff about race that's going on, whether it's a presidential candidate who wants to take a couple of days to decide whether he wants to discredit or disown a relationship with white supremacy and the Ku Klux Klan, or whether it's yet another murder of an African American at the hand of police, or whether it's something about race. How much we need Jackie Robinson, and how contemporary the film that Sarah Burns and David McMahon and I told is, without us intending it to be. That if you know, this has got stories of the Confederate flag and driving while black and stop and frisk and black churches and Black Lives Matter and all that sort of stuff. And I just think that the great gift of history is that it just reminds you there's nothing new under the sun, that human nature remains the same, and by studying the past, we can really involve ourselves with not only good stories from that past, but we're holding a mirror up to our present, and we're looking, as difficult as it may be, at ourselves.
Yeah, you hit on a lot of topics there, and I want to ask you about the mythology of Jackie Robinson. Before that, one follow-up on this is that in terms of your films, if you consider that you have told the story, or you and your partners, in this case, Sarah and David, your daughter, by the way, and son-in-law, if you have told the story well, is that enough of a success, or do you have to have success in terms of viewership, notoriety, press coverage, et cetera?
Yeah, that's a really good question, and goes to the heart of the decision I made nearly 40 years ago to move to public television. I'm a filmmaker. I shoot my my films on film still to some extent, and you know, I still enjoy showing it in a dark room with strangers, which is the great communion of cinema. But you know, you go to festivals and you're seen by a few hundred people. You go to, you know, a limited theatrical, you're seen by a few thousand people. Maybe you get a modest cable show and it's maybe tens of thousands of people, and we get millions on public television. So yes, I believe it's like that old philosophical question, if a tree falls in the forest and a human being doesn't hear it, did it make a sound? Well, that decision is above my pay grade. But I can tell you that if you make a good film and nobody watches it, it's not a good film. I don't subscribe to that idea that you're just the lonely artist and you did a good job and whatever. And so I feel a huge part of my job, our job, is the evangelical dimension, the shoe leather of getting out and having conversations about it and talking to people and saying, I think this is different. I think this is new. I mean, my goodness, we covered Jackie Robinson in our 1994 18 and a half hour series on the history of baseball. I think he was in every episode but one. We did his birth. We did his childhood. We did his courtship of Rachel. We did his early sports career. We did his Negro Leagues. We did his coming up. We did his post, the rest of his baseball career and his post-baseball career. But we didn't do enough, and we clung to some old, or we just repeated some old tropes in mythology. So I feel it's important to get a megaphone. I feel it's important to shout out what it is you have and to call attention to it. And so I've always been a firm believer in that final dimension of just getting, you know, we don't have the budgets of an HBO to plaster this on every newspaper and every subway and bus, but I do think that you can reach people and say, hey, I think this is a good story. And the fact that, you know, say in our last series on the Roosevelts, we got upwards of 35 million people who watched it the first time, that just begins to tell you that people are starved for a complicated story well told.
Can you mention that Jackie was a huge part of your doc on baseball, which came out in 1994. And one of the things that I read in preparing for this interview was that Rachel Robinson was someone who had pitched you on the idea of doing Jackie as a standalone subject, as a solo figure. What's very clear after screening your documentary on Jackie Robinson is that not only does it carry for 4 hours, I'm sure as the filmmaker, you could have done many more hours on Jackie Robinson. So the two-part question, one, how much is Rachel Robinson responsible for this documentary in terms of being a standalone? And two, when did you make the decision that you felt Jackie was a big enough subject to do on his own?
Well, you know, she approached me in the middle of the aughts and said, you know, the baseball series is fine and you did a good job with Jack, but I think he deserves a standalone treatment. I said, of course it does. He did, you know, you're absolutely right. It'd be like a two-part, four-hour thing. She said, I want you to do it. I said, well, Rachel, you know, I'm in the middle of this 10-year plan. I can see all these films laying out there. I don't know where. She goes, well, I'll wait for you. I said, well, don't wait for me. You know, if you find other companies that want to do it, other filmmakers that want to do it. And in fact, she found a couple and she fired them both. And she kept coming to me and saying, I found somebody else. And I said, no, that's great. Go ahead, do it. It's more important that it be done than me doing it. And she went, and when she fired the second one, she goes, no, I want you to do it. And I said, well, Rachel, you can't fire me. If I do this, I'm doing it. And it now looks like Sarah Burns and David McMahon and I had finished the film on the Central Park Five and looked like we had a little bit of daylight. So I said, sure, I'll do this. And she was overjoyed. So the short of it is, without her, there's not this standalone film. But having said that, Jackie deserves a standalone treatment no matter what. I mean, he's one of the most important people in American history, full stop. He isn't just the most important person in baseball. Now, I mean, there may be other people who are better than him, and we can debate that, but there's nobody more important. There's no other person in the history of baseball whose number is retired across all 30 teams. There's no other person in which that number is displayed in all 30 stadiums as retired. That when Mariano Rivera, who consciously chose number 42, retired a while ago, that's the last time anybody would wear number 42, except on April 15th, when everybody, from the bat boy to the manager at first base and the coach at first base and third base and the manager and every single player on the bench and on the field, wear number 42. That is a significant achievement because his story is so remarkable. But it isn't just a good story in baseball. It isn't just a good story in sports, as the columnist George Will reminds us. This is a good story in America and in human history. So Jackie's always going to deserve that standalone treatment. And as I think you begin to understand, no Rachel, no Jackie. She's instrumental to his life. I don't think he would have survived without having her around. And she's instrumental to our film. She's the star of the film. She's in more than anything else. And it's her generosity that made it, not just her persistence with me, but her willingness to open up not only the Jackie Robinson Foundation, which she started and sustains magnificently over the many decades she's been without him, but she opened up her heart. And this is a story not without significant tragedy. This is a story that's painful. And our job as filmmakers, historical filmmakers, is to wake the dead, if you will, make people who are long gone come alive. And then in this case, kill them off, because that's what happens. Nobody gets out of this human life alive. And so we did that. And so it must have been incredibly painful for her. At the same time, it's what she wanted. And this is a 93-year-old woman with all her marbles and such great leadership. And she's one of my heroes in addition to her husband. She is a remarkable woman. So, you know, no Rachel, no me.
And as you watch this film, you'll see just how remarkable Rachel Robinson is in terms of when the Robinsons went to Daytona Beach for their first, not even major league, but their sort of first professional baseball outing. And you see Rachel in Jackie's early days in Brooklyn, how important she was to just having somebody for Jackie to be with, to lean on. She is, I agree with you, just a remarkable American.
Wish you could catch every Major League Baseball game? Now you can. Only T-Mobile customers can get a free year-long MLB.TV premium subscription. That's a $109.99 value for free, so they never miss a game. Hurry up and sign by April 10th to catch any out-of-market game all season long. That's 2,430 games and over 7,000 hours of baseball that will never touch your data plan this season. Thanks to Binge On, only from T-Mobile, you can stream your favorite team's games without using any of your data. T-Mobile has you covered, unlike those other guys. So get your free MLB.TV premium subscription by April 10th and catch every moment all season long. Switch to the Uncarrier today. If you're already a T-Mobile customer, sign up at T-Mobile.com/MLB. Now, sign up for MLB.TV while on T-Mobile's network. New MLB.TV premium subscribers only. Blackout and other restrictions apply. Visit MLB.TV for details. Binge On is available to T-Mobile customers with a qualifying plan. Detectable video typically streams at DVD quality. Video from participating services does not count against full-speed data on our U.S. network. Third-party subscription charges may apply. One of the things that you mentioned in terms of Jackie Robinson being mythologized, and that's the case. And I wonder, you know, even in watching your film, the story about Pee Wee Reese and how he walked over and put his arm around Jackie, I appreciate that you basically said no one has any real evidence that this happened. But it speaks to, Ken, the larger idea that we mythologized the Robinson story for what we want it to be. In the midst of marinating on Jackie Robinson for a couple of years, did you come up with a premise as to why we have mythologized Jackie Robinson so much?
Well, it's very complicated. Part of it is just, you know, the superficiality of that media culture. It's easier to permit that little story. It's also important for us to realize in our long and complicated history of race, what we like about Jackie is that he was being a good Negro back then, right? He was turning the other cheek. We always have it postulated that it's Branch Rickey who's God, right? Who then, like right. Michelangelo's painting, comes down and touches Jackie Robinson, making him his son, and he turns the other cheek, and that's all we ever show. That's what the movie 42 shows. That's what the children's book show. And we don't show where he came from Jim Crow America, where his mom has to get him out of there because African-American boys are being lynched. You know, human beings are being lynched for no reason at all, that he has to put up, even when he moves to supposedly enlightened Pasadena, with all this Jim Crow-like crap from, you know, segregated swimming pools and neighbors burning crosses and throwing stones and calling him names and all this other stuff that he has to put up with. And then when he does come up to baseball and he does turn the other cheek, this fiery, competitive guy, that's the real story. How does he do it? Then we want to turn the story around just to that. So the Pee Wee Reese myth is just that. It's just a myth, and it's for white people to have, no pun intended, skin in the game. You know, we want to be part of this story. We want to believe, as Jonathan Eich said, that we would act well, and Jackie was in, and the Dodgers were at Crosley Field in Cincinnati, and he was getting horrible racist abuse, and the legend is that Pee Wee throws his arm around him, and there's a statue outside the Great American Ballpark to that right now, and that's really good. There's a children's book written about it, but it didn't happen. Jackie played first base that year. Pee Wee would have had to walk across the whole diamond to put his arm around him, and there's no mention of it in Jackie's autobiography. The white press doesn't mention it, and more importantly, the black press, which would have run 15 related articles, doesn't mention it. And Rachel says, when they were going to build a statue, I begged them not to do that. So you know, in her very polite and diplomatic fashion, that it didn't happen. Maybe later on, when he's at second base and they turn a great double play or something, they're telling each other a joke, they put their arms around each other, and it migrates back in time. Who knows who did it? Red Barber? Somebody. But we pushed that story along in 1994 because we want to believe it. But it's really true all the way along the line that in some ways a lot of this is to make sure that we don't give too much agency to the black guy, that really he's there because of important white people who helped pave the way from him or said he was okay. And more importantly, let's not talk about the time when he was no longer required to turn the other cheek, when he fought back against umpires and opposing players, when he argued about the Yankees not being integrated, when he pushed for civil rights after that, when he made even his own teammate Roy Campanella unhappy, and Roy was you know, born up in poverty in Philadelphia, and he's just saying, oh, I'm here, don't rock the boat, Jackie. And Jackie hated that. And he believed that he, unless every African American could achieve the same status of him, which is not true to this day, then he had work to do. So I think, you know, making a film about Jackie Robinson is saying that there's work to do. And part of it, you know, you brought up, Richard, at the very beginning, this notion of process. Part of it is, what are the processes we all use, either spoken or unspoken, conscious or unconscious, that we do to help sort of move this into the kind of groove that we think is palatable and good tasting?
Ken, when you, Sarah, and David are working on this at the start, do you blueprint or sketch out some kind of outline as to here's how we see the arc of the story, or do the interviews themselves then dictate how the arc of the story will be?
Well, first of all, we're dealing with history, and the best story is and then, and then, and then. That doesn't mean you can't do a flashback or even do a foreshadowing of something that's going to come. But basically, good storytelling is and then, and then, and then, one foot after the other. So you know you have an arc of a life. You know it's going to begin in 1919, and it's going to end in 1972 at his death. And so what you do is you begin to write. Sarah and Dave are the principal authors of the script, and you begin to collect interviews, and you begin to collect images, and then you start mixing it up. And what you want to do is not impose yourself, because by imposing yourself, it allows you to make convenient short hops and sort of decisions in which you cut across places. And so, for example, we think that Branch Rickey decides on bringing up one player. Well, Branch Rickey wanted to bring up several black players, but there had been, and we keep thinking of him as the only person interested in doing this. Well, in fact, there was huge pressure. For decades, the African-American press had been pushing for this, and the left-wing press, including the Communist Daily Worker. Oops, yikes, we don't like to talk about left-wing. We don't like to talk about communists. Let's not bring that up, please. You know, they're pushing for it.
Isn't that Lester Rodney? Am I right about that? Is that?
Yeah, Lester Rodney. Right. And the left-leaning, and I'm not crazy, left-leaning Republican mayor of New York, Fiorella LaGuardia, is pushing for it. And so are black communists. Oh, there's that word again. City councilman from Harlem is pushing for it. So what happens is that Rickey, who thinks he's going to be able to make a decision in his own swell time, all of a sudden has to suddenly decide, and Jackie Robinson's in front of him for a whole bunch of accidental reasons, and he remembers him as a great football star, and he remembers him for the court-martial, and he goes, yeah, this is the kind of guy I want, so let's go check him out. And Jackie is, of course, the perfect guy to do it. He doesn't have the talent of Sam Jethro or Marvin Williams or, you know, Roy Campanella or Larry Doby or some of the others, but he's perfect for Rickey in this case, and he ends up being not only a spectacular baseball player, but someone who can carry the weight of his shoulders. Let's just for 1 second stop and realize that on April 15th, 1947, Martin Luther King was a junior at Morehouse College. Harry Truman hadn't integrated the military. There were no organized sit-ins at lunch counters, except Jackie had done that on his own as a teenager. Brown versus Board of Education, which outlawed segregation in the schools, hadn't been a Supreme Court decision. Rosa Parks was still a decade away from deciding not to give up her seat at a Montgomery, Alabama bus. And Jackie had done that 3 years before. So you begin to see, as Martin Luther King said, that Jackie was a sit-inner before sit-ins, a freedom rider before freedom rides. And all of a sudden, this takes on a huge, huge social context that isn't just, oh, geez, here is this interesting and good Negro who turns the other cheek and does this, but this is one of the great moments since emancipation, since the end of the Civil War. It's not to say that there aren't lots of black leaders, A. Philip Randolph with his Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters and W.E.B. Du Bois and Booker T. Washington and even Marcus Garvey and lots of other unnamed heroes who are pushing for equal rights. But here in our national pastime, in our national game, we are advancing the first African-American in the modern age. And to give you an idea of what baseball was missing, just think that in the years after Jackie arrived, where the National League begrudgingly, and one or two per team, like a quota, African-Americans, the African-Americans won the MVP in the National League 9 out of the next 11 years. That just tells you what you're missing. and what's been missing. So when people try to tell you, oh, the 1920s with Babe Ruth is the golden age, or no, the 1920s with Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig and Joe DiMaggio is the golden age, or the 40s, or, you know, it's not until April 15th, 1947, can you even press restart and begin to understand when the golden age might have begun. And if you do, at the heart of that restart is Jack Roosevelt Robinson, the proud grandson of a slave. Now, do you want to know him in his full dimension, or would you rather have it just be the superficial, syrupy, sugar-coated Madison Avenue sanitized version of the past? And Sarah Burns and David McMahon and I chose the former and not the latter.
Have you ever asked yourself why razors are one of the only products in the drugstore that are locked under a plexiglass case? It's because good razors cost too much, so much that people are more likely to steal them than just about any other product in the drugstore. That's why two guys started Harry's.com. They sell high-quality blades that provide a close, comfortable shave for half the price you're used to. If you are using Harry's razors, you know what an awesome shaving experience it is. So say goodbye to expensive razors. Say goodbye to the razors that cost so much. The Patriots play in a stadium named after them. If you want to hear from great Harry's razors users, I recommend both Ben Eagle and Dan Bloom, two of our podcast guys. They have used Harry's razors, and they swear by them. Harry's gives you factory direct prices. They cut out the middleman and ship their products right to your door. So stop getting ripped off. Harry's starter set is the best option for new customers, and it's a great deal for just $15. You get a razor handle, foaming shave gel, and three of Harry's five-blade German-engineered razors. Plus, for listeners of this show, Harry's is giving you $5 off your first purchase by using the promo code SIMedia. That's the promo code SIMedia. So you go to harrys.com right now. That's harrys.com. Make sure you use our code SIMedia checkout to let them know who sent you.
How long did you guys work on the film from conception to completion? How long did this take?
Well, it's I would say more than 5 years, but not every bit of that is in production. You know, you're thinking about it, you're reading, you're doing research, you're fundraising, you know, where it's in public television, it's all grant funded. I don't just say, I'm going to do a film on Jackie Robinson, snap my fingers, and I've got the whole budget. It takes a lot of really interesting people, Bank of America, our corporate sponsor, the Better Angels Society, a nonprofit of folks, well-to-do people around the country who've contributed to our film, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, PBS. Itself, some foundations, the Arthur Vining Davis Foundations and others. All those sorts of groups have to sort of be assembled, but you're looking for pictures, you're mining the various archives, you're trying to figure out the story, and more often than not, you're actually trying to wean yourself, kind of like, you know, giving up cold turkey, a bad habit. Some of those old stories that you just feel, it's so much simpler to just say, Pee Wee Reese did it, or Branch Rickey is in charge of this, or this is what happened, where and Sarah Burns and David McMahon were really good at reminding me, because I'd already done it once, they hadn't, of there was a new story to tell, and it might have been complicated, but it was refreshing, and it changed the dynamics. It made some things less sentimental, which is a good thing, made some things less nostalgic, which is a good thing, but made other parts so richly, emotionally powerful in the real sense of the word that it paid off for all of the complication that you now had to work into it.
Is there one archival find, Ken, that you, Sarah, and David, like the find was really something great above all the rest, that something you never expected to get that you landed for this film?
You know, I'll tell you that when you work on something like this for several years, and Sarah and Dave would be much better at telling you this because they oversaw most of that, what has been for all of my professional life, this incredibly hard but also incredibly rewarding, you know, detective story in which one clue leads to another, that you're always coming up with an image, or that, you know, that famous image is but one of a whole roll taken by this photographer, and we just found his contact sheet, and that means we now get to do several shots of that, or this footage no one had seen before because no one had been searching for it. So to me, right off the bat, I would say it's the footage of Jackie at the August 28th, 1963 March on Washington, the famous March on Washington, Dr. King's I Had a Dream, where he's there with his arm around his second son, David, and he's worked into it, and no one had seen that footage before. It's always, when people went looking, it was doing it from a different perspective, usually a Dr. King civil rights perspective, and we were looking at it as a civil rights Dr. King perspective, but with the added Jackie Robinson. So sometimes when you're deep in the archives, you get a hit, and a card suggests that maybe if you look at this other piece of film, and you might have to look for a half an hour, and there is this priceless 20 seconds of Jackie talking. You know, I don't want to give away too much, but after a tragedy in his life, there's a reporter's interviewing him about that tragedy, and it is just so, so moving, and I'd never seen that footage before, ever, and I think that it's just, it isn't, you know, everybody, every filmmaker wants to say new and never before seen archives, rare and never before seen photographs. It's true. But what you know is that if you stay at it for years and years and years, just the process of looking is on a daily basis going to bring you in contact with images. And you know, Richard, there's lots of stuff that we didn't use that was a revelation to us. And we didn't use it because it wasn't good. It just didn't fit. Or somehow in the course of editing, that wonderful scene got taken out, not because it still wasn't wonderful, but it didn't fit. You know, even two hours has its own limitations when, as you were saying, you know, you could do 10 hours on Jackie Robinson if you wanted to.
Kim, what is it like collaborating with your daughter and son-in-law on a project, and how do you divvy up the responsibilities?
Well, you know, first of all, I remember when this little girl was a year, year and a half, and a toddler running underneath my editing machines when I was working on a film I made on the history of the Shakers, and seeing her come home from school on the school bus and coming in and to the editing house and just sort of loitering around the tables and picking things up. And I could see her putting a poster or a photograph of Jackie Robinson in her bedroom back in the 90s when she was a little girl. And then I had an opportunity to take an intern and turn him into a filmmaker, David McMahon, and lo and behold, they fell in love and got married. And I never thought that Sarah would go into the business, but she wrote a book about the Central Park jogger case. It's called The Central Park Five, focusing on the five black and Hispanic boys who were falsely accused of this worst of all crimes. Ed Koch called it the crime of the century, and went to jail for it, went and served out their full terms until it was discovered after they'd gotten out that they hadn't done it, and they were exonerated and later settled. And we'd made a film about that, and she caught the bug. And so it's great. And, you know, there were sort of obvious divisions of labor. The more important thing is that every time you make a film, it's a million questions or a million problems. If you see the word problem as pejorative, then I haven't really explained myself well. But if you see it as something to be overcome, every project is at least a million questions, a million problems. And how you solve them, how you answer them, is the key to who you are as a filmmaker. And if you do it quick and dirty, then you end up with something superficial, and Pee Wee Reese would still have his arm around Jackie's shoulders. And that wouldn't be bad. It just wouldn't be as good as it could be. And so as we solve those problems, as we dealt with those questions, it was very interesting that the three of us, no one ever yelled, never an argument. It was like sometimes Sarah and Dave would go, oh, come on. And I'd go, oh, you're right. Or sometimes Sarah and I would say something, or more often Dave and I, as filmmakers with more experience, would say to Sarah, no, it was like this. But it was never a part of winning. It was always a part of doing something better. And this is the way it's always been with all of my colleagues. But when it's your own daughter, you know, your fatherly pride bursts. And David McMahon is one of the best filmmakers and writers I know. So it just has been a real, real treat. And they happen to have made, during the process of this, two other co-productions, my two grandchildren.
Ha! Nice. Very good. A total collaborative effort there.
Well, I didn't have anything to do with that.
Well, that's true.
But I certainly enjoy them every time I can.
That's great. The documentary obviously has a lot of really thoughtful and interesting voices. But the two people, obviously, who stand out, given their stature and roles, are Barack Obama and Michelle Obama. And I wonder, how does one go about getting the President of the United States and the First Lady for a documentary on Jackie Robinson?
Well, first of all, you ask very politely. And you do it whenever they're available, not on your schedule. No, I just sort of felt that who could talk about being the first black than the first black, you know? And as our story progressed, and I just had the good fortune to be with the First Lady and say, you know, I'm interviewing the president, I'd be so honored if you would participate in it, because Rachel is such a huge force. And she said, I'd be honored. And so then all of a sudden what happens as you're watching the film is that you have these four individuals, two couples, hurtling through different spaces and time, who are nonetheless talking about the same moment. And that is going through a door that you are the first person to go through and having a lot of stuff heaped on you because of the color of your skin and needing to come home and find a refuge. As the president said, to go home and find somebody who loves you and has your back. And you suddenly realize it's one of the funniest and most moving scenes at the same time is a scene with the president and the first lady talking about how smart it was for Jackie to have picked Rachel. Yeah. And it's funny because it's got every couple's, anybody who's ever been married knows what it is to have a conversation when you're finishing or trying to finish or trying to make sure that the other person understands what you're saying. But the fact that it's the most powerful couple on earth, and that they, too, have gone through some of the stuff that Jackie and Rachel are in the process of our narrative beginning to go through, I think it does something that you want history to do, which is not just be 1 and 1 equals 2, but those rare moments when 1 and 1 equals 3. And that's all any artist is looking for, any musician, any person in love, anything that we are trying to get out of art or faith or our lives that gives it meaning is that kind of thing. And at that moment, you know, I'm very grateful for all the other comments that the president and the first lady make. They're very thoughtful and cogent, and they're a hugely important force in the film. But that one moment with its humor, but also deep, deep power, really moves me to my core. And it made me appreciate even more not only what Jackie and Rachel had to go through, but what the president and the first lady had to go through. Because as he says many times, you know, it isn't just what you're doing, it's people questioning whether you should be there doing it. That's a big difference then. I don't know what the color of your skin is. I'm a white person, and I haven't had that in my life. I don't have to be that much better, as the first lady says, just to be equal. You know, I don't have to prove it that much more. So I like that part of it, and I'm very grateful that they made the time for us. I'm deeply honored that they gave us the time and were able to be so articulate and so transparent. You know, they're not guarded there. They are themselves, and that's a great gift in and of itself as well.
Yeah, it's definitely worth paying attention to Barack Obama's expression when Michelle is talking about that relationship. It kind of makes the shot, actually.
It's the money shot. Yep.
Yeah, interesting. One last one on that, and then we'll finish up on one more. Is there any part of you as a filmmaker, and not just you, Ken, obviously David and Sarah too, when you get someone as powerful and as well known as Barack Obama, do you almost have to, as the filmmaker, try to not overuse them because of who they are, and you know that having a president in a film is prestigious, but is there any party that almost has to censor using the Obamas too much just because they are, in fact, the Obamas?
What a smart question that is. Let me go back and say, people ask me, who aren't as smart as you, were you scared interviewing the president of the United States? And I remember in the hour or so that we had to wait sort of in holding in the West Wing before we were led to the place where we were going to set up, and then we set up and then had to wait some more until the president and then later the president and first lady were there. I was beginning to wonder, would I be nervous? Would I do the interview as well as I try to do other interviews? The second he walked in, all I wanted was the best possible stuff. It was like I was interviewing anybody else. And that applies to the editing too. Nobody gets preferential treatment. And what's great about a democracy is, and what the president knew and the first lady knew, is that I was just going to edit it to what worked. And we did, and they are a significant and important role, but they're nowhere near as big as, say, Rachel or Sharon, his daughter, or even Howard Bryant or Gerald Early or Harry Belafonte. They are significant and important and noteworthy because of who they are. But I didn't have to think once, am I trying to put him in because he's the president, or am I taking him out because he's the president? You know, I heard somebody say to me, an editor, he said, there's only one law of editing, which is a shot lasts as long as it lasts. Hmm. And everybody goes, okay, thanks a lot. But it's really, really true. And at the same time, the only thing that's in a film should be what works. And, you know, the only time the president and the first lady, like everyone else in the film, like every piece of music, like every shot, like every talking head, like every first-person voice read magnificently by Jamie Foxx, is because it works.
Ken, the last one I have for you is you clearly have an interest in sports, or I should be specific to you clearly have an interest in baseball. Obviously, we saw the baseball doc in 1994, and this Jackie Robinson doc, again, shows your love of baseball, or if nothing else, your love of storytelling within the larger confines of sports. Is there anything that's out there, whether it's you or Sarah and David, that you would like to examine in the future that falls under a sports rubric?
Yeah. Well, another film that I made was in 2005. I made a film called Unforgivable Blackness, The Rise and Fall of
Jack Johnson, right.
And I'm drawn not to the sport of boxing, but to the humans of boxing. And so I believe that there's a good Muhammad Ali film that has yet to be made. And I know that Sarah Burns and David McMahon agree, and that's one of the things we've talked about. I do think that baseball is the greatest game that's ever been invented, by far, bar none. I'm a good American. I love football. I love basketball. But baseball's, you know, head and shoulders beyond it. I mean, every football story begins, Joe Montana threw a pass, and hit Jerry Rice in the end zone with 3 seconds and we won, or Michael Jordan got the inbound pass with less than a second and his three-pointer won the game. But every baseball story begins, my dad took me to this game, or my mom took me to this game, or I took my kid or my grandson to this game. And then you should have seen the catch that Willie Mays made, or the this that happened. And I like that about baseball. It's the only sport without a clock where the defense has the ball and where the person scores and not the ball. That for 1,000 reasons. So I can imagine coming back. We did an update of baseball called the 10th inning in 2010 that covered the 90s and aughts, steroids and money and Red Sox winning and Yankee dominance and Braves and all sorts of stuff like that. And I suppose if the Cubs, who, as you know, are having a bad century, win, there should be an 11th inning. But I would say between baseball and boxing is where, you know, where the really great stories, the nub of the kind of things that interest me, take place. And I would never say, you know, tomorrow I could decide to do something on football or basketball, you know, or track or something like that. But you know, as what I feel in my heart draws me as a civilian in a day-to-day business, the stories that interest me are nearly always baseball stories.
Ken, you want to, as we end this, you want to venture a prediction on how your Red Sox will do this year?
Oh, well, it's the spring. They're going to win the World Series. why would you ask such a foolish question? I know this without a shadow of a doubt. We've added David Price. We've made some adjustments. We did pretty poorly last year, but the back half was a rejoicing of all the young talents on our field, from Jackie Bradley Jr. to Xander Bogaerts to, you know, some of the old folks. It's going to be the swan song for David Ortiz. What more could you ask?
All right. Hope springs eternal on Yawkey Way.
It does indeed.
It has to. As well as in Toronto and New York too. All right, the guest has been Ken Burns, and his upcoming documentary with Sarah Burns and David McMahon is Jackie Robinson, airing on PBS on April 11th and April 12th. I've screened it, as I will write. I thought it was sensational, And the thing I really appreciate about Ken's work is that he's a historian and he doesn't mythologize stuff. He presents things as they, as a historian would, and that's something I respect. It's not a feature film. It's history and it's important. So Ken, thank you for taking the time to be on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. But beyond that, I really respect and appreciate your work, and thank you for what you have you've done for us in terms of being a documentary filmmaker.
Well, that's very, very kind of you to say. I really enjoyed our conversation today. Thank you, Richard.
Thanks, Ken.
Baseball is back. The crack of the bat, freshly mowed grass, hot dogs, beer. It's beautiful when baseball returns come April. And the return of baseball, of course, means daily fantasy baseball. If you are not playing FanDuel this season, you are missing out on the most fun a baseball fan can have. On FanDuel, you choose. Do I compete to win cash from friends around the world? Do I start a listener league with my friends? Either way, you get to be the GM, study the matchups, get your money ball on, and set your winning lineups. Entry fees start at just $1, and there's no season-long commitment. Play for one day, play for 180 days, play for the playoffs. Here's the best part. FanDuel is giving new players their first game risk-free. Here's what you do. Just go to FanDuel.com and enter the code SIMedia. Then enter a FanDuel league or start one with your friends. If you don't win any prize in your first contest, you get that $10 right back to your FanDuel account to play for more. That's FanDuel.com with my code SIMedia for a risk-free tournament at up to $10.
Okay, back in the studio, wrapping up real quick. My thanks to Ken Burns. The documentary is terrific. Even if you're not a baseball fan, Jackie Robinson's story is really, really interesting. And again, this is not the feature version of Jackie Robinson. This is, I think, a real sober but elegant look at his life and what he meant to this country and probably what it cost him as well. I'll bring in Bette Marston, who has not seen the film, but is a big baseball fan, so I imagine you'll be watching this.
Yes, I certainly hope so. I just want to laugh at the fact that he's excited about having David Price as a Rays fan. I think that David Price has certainly hit his peak and is on the downswing.
Really?
But
he was pretty good with the Blue Jays last year, though, no?
He was. I don't think he's going to be great with the Red Sox.
He's not that old. You're talking to this guy like he's 39. Isn't he like 31 years old? That's not ancient for a pitcher.
For what they're paying him.
They are paying him a lot of money.
You got to keep that in mind, too. You got to keep the money in mind.
But hopefully you enjoyed that. Again, Ken Burns is not the traditional guest we have here, like a traditional member of the sports media, but I thought he'd be really interesting given the project that he's coming out with. So again, the date is April 11th and 12th on PBS. Check your local listings. My thanks to our previous podcast guests as well, Hubie Brown and Renee Young and Zach Lowe. We got some good ones coming up, Bill Raftery and Kara Lawson, so some more basketball stuff for you. My thanks to Dan Bloom and Ben Eagle, Paul Fichtenbaum, Ryan Hunt, and my producer, Bette Marston. This is Richard Deitch. We'll see you again on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Do you know about the Locked On Podcast Network, the number one daily sports podcast network? Locked On has a daily podcast on every NBA and NFL team, plus a growing lineup of college and MLB teams. You get a daily bite-sized podcast giving you the latest on your team from the local experts. Lakers fans, search Locked On Lakers. Cowboys fans, search Locked On Cowboys. Just search Locked On, your favorite team, on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.